What I want to focus with you on tonight and next week at this same more or less time is how should an intelligent person who is part of the world at large in the beginning of the 21st century approach learning the first chapter of the book of Genesis, the story of creation in 6 days. We are at an era that has been privileged to witness many scientific discoveries. Our understanding of science and the birth of the universe from a scientific standpoint has exploded in the last 100 years. For those of you who have been keeping abreast of the news, you'll know that one of the last pieces of Einstein's theory this past Thursday was confirmed. 100 years later, he predicted the existence of gravitational waves, disturbances in the field of gravity and the fabric in space and time caused by cataclysmic events elsewhere in the universe. Gravitational waves were actually detected, heard, by a special antenna created to be able to receive them and pick them up. So we've actually heard the sound of two black holes colliding with one another a billion light years away. In a world in which we are privy to those kinds of discoveries, how do we come back in shul and read the first chapter of the book of Genesis and understand it? And what is it? How do we do that? So a couple possibilities, you know, we can kind of put out there. One possibility is that which I ascribe to Sylvia, a woman I came to know in Baltimore a number of years back. She was an English teacher, non-frum lady, who was a tutor of a young elementary school or sixth grade kid in one of the frum schools in Baltimore. And she told me a story about her interaction with her student that she was tutoring. Student was very vexed one day, and she asked him what was wrong. He says, "Well, I've been learning about the theory of evolution." And she said, "So what's wrong?" He said, "Well, I just wish that my Rebbe from the morning could come into my science class and tell my teacher why he's wrong." Right? And and he was very disturbed about the whole thing. So she said to him, "Well, why don't you talk it over with your father?" She wasn't from, she didn't feel like she had the authority to advise him on this, but her father was a prominent physician in the community, a frum fellow. So she said, "Why don't you talk it over with your father?" Next day he comes back, and she said, "Did you get a chance to talk to him?" And he says, "Yes." And she said, "So how did it go?" So he said, "Well, my father told me that what I learn in the morning with my Rebbe, that I should put in one box, and what I learn in the afternoon with my biology teacher, I should put in another box. And those are two separate boxes. And those two separate boxes, you don't mix the boxes." So she said, "Okay, and what do you think?" And he said, "My father was talking about two boxes, but I only have one life, you know?" And that was his problem. You know, if you only have one life, how do you live with two boxes? So that's the Sylvia approach. You know, two boxes doesn't quite work so well. Are there any other approaches? Here's one other approach which might have some, might be able to hold some water in reconciling Torah and science questions. And I think it's a step in the right direction, but I think it's just one step, and I'd like to try to take this step and one more step with you tonight. This approach, and you can find this in an Aleph Beta video that we produce in Aleph Beta. If you go and search for Noach, there's a video that we did on, which I think you showed in your classroom, one of your rabbis here by Trump. I think we called it "Why doesn't the Torah talk about the dinosaurs?" or "Where are all the dinosaurs in the Torah?" And basically, this approach basically says the following, that, you know, I read a book by Mortimer Adler. Mortimer Adler was a contemporary philosopher. He died not long ago. He wrote a book called How to Read a Book. And in this book, he tries to give you, he says most books aren't worth reading, but there's about 100 or so that are. And he gives you a guide towards reading the challenging books that are out there. You know, how should you attack a book that's above you, that's difficult to read? And one of the pieces of advice that he gives you is that before you begin to read a book, you must understand its genre. If you don't understand the genre of the book, then you're doomed to ask the wrong questions about it, and you will ultimately misinterpret it. So, for example, he says, if you're reading a chemistry textbook and you think you're reading a book of poetry, you are going to misinterpret the book. If you are conversely reading a book of poetry, you think you're reading a chemistry textbook, you're also going to ask the wrong questions about it. So if you read Carl Sandburg's poem, The Fog Crept In on His Little Cat Feet, and you start asking, I don't understand, fog, it's not a cat, it can't creep, it doesn't have feet, it's not like fog. Those are the wrong questions to ask about the poem. You don't get that it's poetry, right? You don't understand how to attack that book. So you must understand the genre of the book, which leads me to the question that I'll pose to you tonight. What genre is the Torah? If you had to assign a genre, if you were a librarian, right, what kind of genre would you say the Torah is? Let me throw that out to you. Does the Torah have every book has a genre? So what genre is the Torah? By the way, when I ask you a question, just letting you know that I'm actually asking you a question. Okay, you're supposed to respond. You're not just supposed to kind of sit there and it's not rhetorical, right? I'm actually asking you. So if you're a, right, what kind of genre is the Torah? Anyone want to take a stab at that? So you might say it's a history book because it definitely has lots of stories in the book, right? So it's totally telling us lots of stories. Problem with the idea that the, what's the problem with the notion that the Torah is a history book?
Doesn't start with the 12th chapter of Shema.
Well, it could be a history book going all the way back to the beginning of creation, right? But if it were a history book, what defies our expectations about the Torah if it's a history book? Well, the past, and you can't do the future in the history. If it's history, it is the past. But why doesn't it make a good history book? All right, so you have the Chazal with Ein Muktam Mochar B'Torah. Okay, that's true. The other thing is that it's got too many laws in it to be a history book. I mean, there's 613 laws in it. That's a little too many laws for a history book. So you might say, yeah, you're right, it's a legal treatise. Well, that's true, but it definitely has too many stories in it to be a legal treatise. So, like, what kind of genre is it? One way of looking at the Torah is, as somebody else here suggested, to suggest that its genre is guidebook. It is there to guide you. To guide you in how to live as a Jew, both at an individual level and at a communal level, with those around you, in relationship with those who count, in relationship with God, in relationship to your family, in relationship to others, relationship to other nations. It's a guidebook. It's trying to teach you how to behave. As a guidebook, it uses several disciplines to guide you. And by the way, this changes the way you view things in the Torah, if it's a guidebook. In other words, what that means is part of what you need to guide you is laws, right? Laws provide some guidance as to how to act. But it's interesting that the Torah is a guidebook that is not just composed of laws, which seems to suggest that the discipline of law itself is not comprehensive enough. It is too narrow to provide all the guidance that a human being has, even if it's God writing the laws. And therefore, part of the things in the book are stories. Because stories also guide you in a way that laws can't. And when you put those together, stories and laws, you can kind of get the guidance that you need with a little bit of philosophy to be able to kind of go out there in the world. Now, if this is true, the fact that it's a guidebook, changes things. It changes how you relate to the stories. It changes how you relate to the laws. It makes certain things more understandable. For example, take the Chazal, which we talked about before, which one of you alluded to. Ein muktam amocher b'Torah. There's no chronological order in the Torah. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean there's no chronological order in the Torah. It means that you can't count on the chronological order in the Torah to be correct, because sometimes it's not. So, did you ever get bothered when you heard that in school? You say to yourself, like, well, what kind of book is that? Like, if you're going to write a book already, and you're going to tell me history, and tell me stories, so what good does it do to put things out of order? Are you trying to confuse me? Why would you do that? The answer is that if it's not a history book, if you're writing a history book, that would be true, but if it's a guidebook, so what if you can guide me better by putting some things out of order, right? What if, in writing Sefer Shoftim, I want to make a point by putting Pilegesh Begiva at the end of the book instead of at the beginning of the book, because I think it's a capstone that gives you a way of understanding everything? What if Nachash HaAmoni, who wars against Shaul in his first war as king, wasn't actually named Nachash, snake, but that's the name that the Torah gave him because that's how he acts, and you want to understand who Nachash was, he was the snake, right? So if you're not telling me history, but you're trying to guide me and you're trying to explain things to me, so that might make sense. That might be a step towards understanding how to come to grips with the creation story. If the creation story is not a history treatment or not a scientific treatment of creation, we might say it's a guidebook treatment of creation, which is to say that part of what the Torah is going to tell me, everything it needs to guide me. Now notice there's a lot of things the Torah leaves out. There's a lot of chronology, there's a lot of history that we don't have anything about, which again, if it's a history book, doesn't make any sense, but if it's a guidebook, you know, if there was nothing in the Cretaceous period that you now need to know to guide you in how you live your life with people and those around you, so then the Torah could be excused for not talking about dinosaurs. It's not trying to give you a comprehensive account of everything that happened, it's trying to guide you. But the Torah does talk about creation, which would seem to suggest that if it is a guidebook, there is guidance that you can get in your life from the creation story, from how God created the world. And we only have two sessions tonight. We don't have four. If we had four, I would devote two sessions to trying to explicate that idea right there. The notion that there is stuff in creation, that creation itself helps guide us. In what ways does creation itself help guide us? But I don't have four sessions. I only have two, so I'm not really going to talk about that. I will say that if you're interested in that, a good starting place might be the Rav's essay, Lonely Man of Faith, Adam 1 and Adam 2, where he really argues that there's two competing views of creation given in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and 3. And the reason why there's two competing views of creation is because there really are two ways of looking at how creation unfolded, because there's two ways of conceptualizing what human beings are all about. And the literary device that the Torah chooses to use to convey that is to portray the creation in two different ways, to try to give you these two different ways of looking, ultimately, of the creation of man. I have my own little twist on that. Another time we can get into that. But that's not my topic for tonight. But let's say that's true. Let's say that the reason why the creation story is here is because there's stuff you could learn from it that teaches you how to live. And therefore, the Torah is not offering you really a scientific view of creation. The Torah is offering you a guidebook view of creation. Could that perhaps answer our science and religion dilemmas? It might, and that might be good enough to kind of take us home. I want to suggest to you tonight, though, that there is something more to the picture than that. And in order to do so, I'm going to take kind of a devil's advocate position, arguing against the position which I just set out to you. Okay, so I'm going to be the smart aleck who raises a hand at the back of the class. But Rebbe, right, here's my question that I would raise. I'd say, okay, fine. You want me to believe that the creation story is a guidebook and it's not science, right? Okay, I get it. But we agree that creation is actually an event that happened, right? In other words, like, there was something called creation. Like, it actually happened a certain way, right? Now, science would describe how it actually happened. A guidebook, what would a guidebook do? So I might say, if I'm the smart aleck, I would say, like, okay, a guidebook can tell it to me in a different way. A guidebook can talk to me about it in a way that guides me, but it can't fudge the facts. You know what I mean? Like, bottom line, it happened a certain way. I should be able to, if I'm clever enough, reverse engineer the guidebook to be able to get to the actual history of what happened. In other words, like, you know, let's say I'm reading Frommer's Europe. I'm planning a trip to Europe. So Frommer's Europe is also a guidebook. You know what I mean? So I'm learning all about the stuff. Now, in Frommer's Europe, I'm going to have some history. You know what I mean? So maybe it's history from the perspective of a guidebook. Maybe it's the kind of stuff that, you know, you emphasize certain things more than others. But you should be able to, if you wanted to, you should be able to go through Frommer's Guide to Europe and say, oh, yeah, I see. That was like something you were doing to guide me, right? But really, the history is X or something like, you know, you should be able to, let me give you an analogy to it. You should be able to factor out the guidance if you're clever enough. Almost like an algebra problem, right? What? How do you solve an algebra problem? How does algebra work? Algebra works to solve for X. And the problem is, well, I can't solve for X. I got 3X plus 7 minus y. So how do I solve for x? The answer is you have to factor out all the other things other than x until you're just left with x, and then you realize what x equals. You can do that in algebra. There's a way, there's tools that you can get rid of the stuff on this side of the equation. So can we factor out the guidance, so to speak, out of the Torah's way of seeing things, and somehow, by looking at the Torah, can we arrive at a scientific view of what creation actually looked like? Could it be possible to do such a thing? There has to be some relationship of this guidebook thing to the events that actually happened. Do you have any understanding of what I'm talking about? Do you get the idea? Right. This would be the rejoinder. Tonight, I want to suggest to you that you actually can do that. Okay? And for the next 2 weeks, that is the excursion, the great journey that we are going to try to take. Sounds crazy. We were actually going to try to do what I just described to you. We're going to try to read through Bereishis Aleph, the events of the Torah that we know and love so well, 6 days of creation. And what we're going to do is we're going to try to factor out the guidebook part of it and see if by doing so we can arrive at just the facts, ma'am. Just, right, what actually happened, and see if it might bear any resemblance to the story of creation that science tells. Okay? So that's going to be kind of our goal. All right? You kind of got the roadmap here a little bit, more or less. That's what we're going to try to do. I don't expect you to understand exactly how we're going to do that yet, but that's like the basic idea. All right. Now let me jump in with you. Here's the next part of the roadmap. One of the things that I've done with you before, if you've been around at some of the earlier lectures that Rabbi Teitelbaum referenced that we've had here at the Young Israel Lawrence Cedar Burst, is, as and Rabbi Teitelbaum actually mentioned this in his introduction, that one of the things I occasionally do is try to compare different areas of Torah and see how they shed light upon each other. It's not really me. I think it's something that the Torah itself does by creating connections between different areas of texts. Academics will call these intertextual connections, where the Torah seems to refer in one text to another text and seems to suggest that text A cannot really be understood without reference to text B. Text B is kind of like a commentary that you can overlay on text A, which is really a remarkable thing, because if that's true, it means that if somebody would ask you the question, what is the earliest commentator that you can name on the Torah? Then even before Rashi, the Ramban, and Sfarno, even before the Gemara, even before the Chachmei HaMishnah, even before Chazal, the answer you might give is the Torah itself. That the Torah itself is designed in a way that its own texts comment on each other. That when two texts are linked, you can take that second text, sort of place it over the other one, and it's going to be a guide as to how to read its companion text. That's really the magic of intertextuality. I want to suggest to you over these next 2 weeks that we can read creation that way too. Another wonderful guide for creation is the texts in the Torah itself to which creation chapter 1 is intertextually related. I want to suggest to you that there are other texts in the Torah that are companion texts to creation. And if you see what they are, you can overlay them on the creation narrative itself. And what will happen is that, as it always happens with intertextual parallel text, which is that each text sheds light upon the other, which means that the other text is going to help you learn how to read creation, and the creation text is going to teach you how to read the other text too. Now, again, if I had more time than two sessions with you, we would explore a number of different texts which are actually intertextually related to creation. They each, I think, help with different parts of the picture. One of them we actually talked about a couple years back in this very hall, where we talked about the Kriyat Yamsuf story as connected to creation. But I'm not going to repeat that tonight, and maybe one day we'll get to it again. But the text that I do want to explore with you tonight is the story of the construction of the Mishkan of all things, which is kind of where we're up to in Parsha anyway. Construction of the Mishkan is one of those things that seems very abstruse and obscure, and as you're in shul hearing Parshas Truma, so okay, like, you know, you get it, and then Parshas Tetzava, and then you sort of get it again, and then if you're not done with that, you've got Vayakel, and you've got Pikude, where it's all kind of repeated, and then you sort of lose patience. You say, like, why does the Torah spend so much time on the construction of the Mishkan, first the laws for the construction of the Mishkan, then how it was actually constructed? What are we to make of that? I think the laws of the construction of the Mishkan are actually very, very fascinating. And they also, I believe, happen to be intertextually connected to the creation story. So you say, well, that's kind of weird. Is there any logic for the kind of connections that seem to exist between creation and the Mishkan? I think there is. And I think that you can raise a number of questions about creation that the Mishkan will help you answer, and a number of questions about the Mishkan that creation will help you answer. Why should these stories be connected? In what sense might these stories be connected? So, here's the first inkling that they might be. You ever wonder why it's the case that the paradigm for the type of labor that you're not allowed to perform on Shabbos, all 39 categories of labor, according to Gemara, every last one of them is learned out of Melachat HaMishkan. It all comes from the modes by which the Mishkan was constructed. Why is that? Well, the Gemara in Shabbos has a drasha that explains to you why it is. There's a technical, legal reason why it is. It's because at the beginning of Vayakel, the Torah has a smichas parshias, which is there are two parshias, one after another. One is the parsha of the tzivui, the command to construct the Mishkan, and it's juxtaposed with the parsha of Shabbos. Hence, the Talmud infers that one sheds light on the other, one is connected to the other, and it is specifically the laws of, or the labor of the Mishkan, which is the kind of labor which is outlawed on Shabbos. When you come across a Gemara like that, and maybe it's just me, when you come across a Gemara like that, you kind of say to yourself, all right, fine, like, maybe from a technical legal angle, that's what's going on. But you could say to yourself, it kind of bothers me that that's what's going on, because you're telling me that the most basic aspect of Hilchos Shabbos, what everything else is based upon, this whole huge Masechta Shabbos, where people learn all that, the most basic halacha in that is that the paradigm for malacha comes from, of all things, the construction of the Mishkan. can you explain to me why there's any rhyme or reason why that should be true? Like, it's like saying, like, what if I told you it comes from an analysis of the spectrograph that you get from when you take elephant DNA and you pass it through a prism? I mean, it's like, okay, so yeah, I'd nod my head. If the Gemara said that, I would say, yes, it definitely comes from a spectrograph of the DNA of the elephant as you pass it through a prism. You know, that's what it says, and there's a drasha that proves that it's so. Like, is that what's going on? You're telling me, like, there's nothing about Malachas HaMishkan, which is essentially related to Shabbos, but there's a drasha. If you're really Lithuanian, you know what I mean? Maybe you can get away with that, if you're really a Kalta Litvak, right? But you can be forgiven for wondering if there is some sort of rationale that lies behind the legal drasha that connects these two. What might it be?
Those are the two places in the Torah where you have a series of bayas, 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 this creative work in creation, this creative work in the Mishkan, you know, lachashov, machashavos. Granted, in the Mishkan you don't have vayivra, because vayivra is ex nihilo. Mishkan was not ex nihilo, creation was.
Okay, so you say, well, the Mishkan is the example of creative work, and the creation of the universe is the example of created work.
And it uses the same word, vayas.
And it uses the same word of making things, although you have to admit that the word vayas is a rather common word that's not restricted to those things. But you might say that, conceptually at least...
But this is vayas, a series of vayas taking raw materials and making finished product.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the language seems to indicate that the ideas of the creation of the Mishkan and the creation itself are more broadly connected are broadly connected. Right? The language would seem to indicate it. But what if I challenged you and I said, okay, so you've told me that the language is connected.
There's also a purpose.
Okay. But so that's what I'm driving at. But is there a conceptual framework that connects them?
Yeah. Creation is God making something for humanity, and the Mishkan is humanity making something where, at least in a symbolic way, God is supposed to.
Okay, good. Give me your name again.
Robert Kantowitz.
So what Robert says is that now we're getting somewhere, that behind all of this is a conceptual link here, which is the Mishkan is about the creation is about God making something for us. And the Mishkan is about us making something for God. Now let me challenge Robert just a little bit more. Can we define the something a little bit more? Can we sharpen the something? Is there any similarity in the somethings that are being created reciprocally here?
Well, although it's a little bit hard to apply the term to God, it's a place to dwell, b'shachati b'sofa.
Oh, there we go. So actually, what's really happening is that there are two dwelling places being created, right? God is creating a dwelling place for humanity, and maybe humanity reciprocates by creating a dwelling place for God. That may well be true. So it actually might make perfect sense why these two things are related, because all they are mirror images of each other, which is, how do you make a dwelling place for the one that you love? And it might just be, in a way, that if you think about this a little bit more, God makes a dwelling place for us. We make a dwelling place for God. What does that idea that God does something for X and then we do something remind you of in the Torah? Why should we be doing what God does? The answer is we're at Tzelem Elokim. Maybe what it means to be a Tzelem Elohim is to be creative like God. God is the creator, but maybe it doesn't just mean to be creative like God. Maybe what Tzelem Elohim is really saying is that not only do we express our Tzelem Elohim by creating like God created, but maybe our destiny is to create what God created, which is to say, what did God create? God made a place to live for the one that he loved. Maybe our destiny is to do the same, to take our creative energies and to turn them around and to make a place, give me one second, and to make a place for the one that we love. if you even think about it a little bit more, the parallels sharpen a little bit. For example, when you say God made a place for the one that we love, right? So what do we mean by that? God made a place for the one that he loves. How did God do it? So go back to the Kabbalistic concepts of creation, if you will, but even if you don't want to get so heebie-jeebie with the mystical stuff, just think about it from a simple kind of flat-out plain way of thinking about it. What if I asked you, how did creation change the status quo? So you'd say, well, creation's the biggest change for the status quo. Like, first there was nothing, and then there was something. That's a pretty big change. But that's only from your point of view. From God's point of view, it's actually the opposite. From God's point of view, like, you imagine how offended God would be if you came to God. God said to you after 120 years, say, so tell me, how do you think creation changed the status quo? Say, well, first there was nothing, then there was something. So God says, what do you mean first there was nothing? There was me. What, I'm nothing. I'm chopped liver. What do you mean first there was nothing? Actually, it's the other way around. First there was everything, God says. There was me living in my grand world. You know what creation was? It was the opposite. Creation was, I had to diminish myself, so to speak, pull myself in. This is the Kabbalistic concept of Tzimtzum. And actually make room for something else other than me. And that, perhaps, is the great test of love. The real great test of love is how much will you contract yourself to make room for someone who's not you? And the first one who ever did that was God. That's part of the act of creation. And he contracted himself contracted himself in many ways, if you think about it. It wasn't just sort of a physical kind of contraction, although it's again, use the word physical, but it was a contraction in other ways too, in the sense that it actually sort of imposed constraints upon God, who might otherwise be unconstrained. Think about the universe. You know how many constraints the universe needs to operate under? The detection of gravitational waves last Thursday only made that even more clear, right? Which is how many constants, how many laws of physics need to be exactly so in order for the universe as we know it to live? How many, right, the ratio of the nuclear strong force to nuclear weak force, the ratio of the strength of gravity to electromagnetism, the Planck's constant, the inverse square law of gravity, all these things, if they're off by a little bit, you don't have a universe. You either have a universe of black holes, you have a universe of subatomic particles, you don't get a universe. So who is the great lawkeeper? If you think about who is the great lawkeeper, that's actually one of the most mysterious questions that science ever asks, which is, why should it be that there are laws of physics? Who said that the inverse square law of gravity that applies here has to apply in the Andromeda galaxy? Who's the policeman who enforces that one? Right? Why does the universe obey that? It doesn't make any sense. Right? So from a religious standpoint, we might say, well, there is a lawgiver, right? He didn't just give the Torah, he gave the laws of physics. So, but who gets constrained by the laws of physics? You see, we get constrained by the Torah. Who gets constrained by the laws of physics? Who has to keep those? The answer is God does. So what did God do? God constrained himself out of love. Not only was he metzamtzem himself, so to speak, contract himself to make room for the universe, he contracts himself every single minute by constraining himself, by him having to watch laws that don't mean anything to him. God doesn't need laws of physics. God doesn't need space and time. God doesn't need the inverse square law of gravity. God doesn't need any of it. You know why? He keeps it for us. Because for us, life would be impossible without that. Now flip it around. What do? We want to emulate God. What did God do? God took his everything, contracted it, made a place for something else, and started building within it according to law. And kept those laws, because he knew that the only way that the one he could love could survive by keeping those laws. So we do the same thing. We take our everything, which is the universe of space and time. We take a little piece of that, contract it, and say, this is going to be for God. We're going to make this place for God. And we're going to observe laws. Laws that seem crazy, that don't make any sense to us. Laws of Tumah and Torah, of Kodesh and Chol, which are godly laws, have nothing to do with human beings. We're not going to even understand why. And it's going to make no difference to us, but we're going to keep them anyway out of love. Because we want to make a place that's comfortable for God. And God feels comfortable if we keep laws of Torah, if we keep laws of Kodesh and Chol. So we're going to do it the way God wants. The same way God does it, the way people want, in order for them to survive. We keep those laws. And then the person who builds this thing, just like God, guess what his name is? Bezalel. Isn't that an interesting name? If we are created B'Tselem Elohim, what does B'Tselel kind of sound like to you? If not an acronym for B'Tselem Elohim, right? He is the one who does it. He's the one who acts like God and creates like God. So you see what's happening over here? At the very end of this all, God says, okay, little creator, you're imitating me. I get that. I'm big creator. You're imitating me. You're creating this Mishkan. Very nice. I'm going to come dwell in it just like you like. And I want to tell you something, little creator. Create with discipline. Learn from me how to create. Know what I did when I was done creating? Took a day off. I stopped. I pulled back. I didn't feel a need to keep on jiggering with my creation because I realized that the final act of creation, ironically, is stopping to create. And if you never stop to create, if you never pull away, you never really created. So pull away. Let it be. I rested. You should rest too. You should rest the way I rested. How did I rest? I, God said, rested by stopping to do the work that was necessary to make this little apartment and my everything for the one that I love. I used all of this malacha to create the universe. And when Shabbos came, I stopped doing the malacha that I used to create your apartment, the universe. So what should you do? You should rest too. How should you rest? By stopping to do the malacha that you used to create the apartment in your everything for the one that you love. That's the malacha of the Mishkan. That's why the malacha of the Mishkan is the paradigm for why you keep Shabbos. Each creator rests by desisting from using the malacha that they used to create the apartment and their everything for the one that they love. That's what God taught us. So it really does seem like creation of the universe by God and our creation of the Mishkan are related to each other. Our creation of the Mishkan is a mimicry of God's creation of the universe. It would seem. Now my question to you is, how far can you stretch that? How far does that comparison go? Does it go even farther? If it went farther, then it might be the case that by actually examining the laws for the construction of the Mishkan, those laws themselves could teach you something about the laws through which God created the universe. It would stand to reason that that would be so. So, when we look at the Mishkan carefully, could we get insight as to how creation works? Could creation give us insight to how construction of the Mishkan works? Okay, so that's kind of what I'm going to want to explore with you for the few minutes we have left tonight, as well as next week. Somebody had their hand up over there.
I
represent Sal, what you said. Okay, there you go. Okay. Let me continue by raising a number of questions about the creation story and a number of questions about the Mishkan. And I hope next week to come back and answer these questions simply by comparing the two stories to one another. So the answers to the Mishkan story, the problems in the Mishkan, will be found in creation. And the answers for the problems that in creation will be found in the construction of the Mishkan. Though it will shed light on each other. That's the hope. Okay? Let me begin by making life a little bit difficult for you. I'm just going to kind of raise a number of problems, difficulties in each story. Let's start with the creation story. What are some of the basic problems? And by problems, I mean, like, if you're just a simple reader of the story, you're reading the creation story, what seems odd to you? What just like doesn't seem like it makes sense? Now, I don't mean right now. What seems odd to you as a sophisticated, scientifically educated 21st century reader of the Torah, right? Because the Torah wasn't necessarily written just for 21st century readers. So just because you get to bring along your knowledge of you know, Einstein's special theory of relativity, that doesn't make the text strange because it doesn't seem to obviously comport with a theory of science which was just introduced in the last 70 years, right? I mean, the average reader throughout time, right? Your average intelligent reader with no special background in science, you don't have to be a Groysa Chacham and understand, you know, quantum mechanics to be able to start asking questions about the 6 days of creation that just don't seem to add up, right? I'm talking about internal basic questions in the text. And let me actually just take a moment to define my terms here. Generally speaking, whenever you read any narrative in the Torah, whenever you read anything in the Torah, there's two kinds of questions you can ask about it. You can ask what I call internal questions or external questions. An external question means that you come to the text with baggage. You ask a question that's external to the text. The reason why you have the question is because there's something in your experience, right, which you consider problematic for the text, but it's a function of you more than it's a function of the text. So, for example, you're reading the book of Yonah, and you see that Yonah was in the fish for 3 days. You say, I don't understand that. How can anybody live in a fish for 3 days? It's crazy. It's impossible. So that's your question. How bothered should we be by this question if you're learning the book of Yonah? Not so bothered. This is a question that you have. It's not an internal question in the text. The author of the text believed in miracles. You don't believe in miracles. Okay, yasher kach, so you don't believe in miracles. It's not a question about Sefer Yonah that you don't believe in miracles. It's a question because you have an issue about miracles. There's no problem within the book, right? The book is, comes with a certain assumption that we believe in miracles. This was a miracle. The book is not problematic. However, if you come along, you're reading Sefer Yonah, you say, I don't understand. Verse 1 says that God comes to Yonah and says, Kum lechel Nineveh, go to Nineveh and call against him. And verse 2 says that he ran away to Tarshish without telling me why. Why did he run? That's a reasonable question. That's a question that emerges from the book. I am willing to accept everything in the book, right? But I just don't get how sentence number 1 jives with sentence number 2. Explain this to me. That's a reasonable question. So I guess what I'm asking is, what are the internal questions in Genesis chapter 1, not the external questions? You come to me with a problem from particle physics, that's an external question. You come to me with, I'm just reading the text, I don't understand how this verse comports with that verse, or, you know, I have no special scientific knowledge, but it just seems to fly in the face of everything I know about reality, what it is that you're telling me. These are basic questions that any reader would ask. They're not external questions. They're questions that sort of emerge from the text. And the reason why you're more interested in those questions, by the way, than external questions is because if you're trying to understand a text, one of the great tools to understanding a text are questions. Questions that the text embeds right there within the document. And if you can resolve those questions, you're going to get to a deeper understanding of the text. What are the internal questions in Genesis chapter 1? Let me actually throw that out to you, if you have any, before I launch on my list. Anything that always bothered you about Genesis chapter 1? Just on the face of it, just reading the psukim, just very hard to understand. Yeah. No? Oh, you weren't raising your hand. Okay, how it all happened in 1 day? 1 day seems like a very short amount of time for this to happen. Okay, but maybe if you're God, you can do it in a day, right? I mean, if I don't understand what a day is, although the truth is the idea that it's a day seems kind of hard to believe that it's a day anyway before there's a sun. So days seem on the face of it to be metaphorical because it's hard to conceive of a 24-hour period before a sun. Okay, the truth is it's not just tohu vavohu. Let's just look at that verse. That verse is a strange verse, right? Let's go to verse 2 of the Genesis story. Very peculiar verse. Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et haaretz. In the beginning, the Lord created the heavens and the earth. Good, right? I'm totally fine with that verse. The next verse is where the trouble starts. Va'aretz hayta tohu vavohu. V'choshech al panei tahom. V'ruach Elokim ra'chefet. The question is how you read that verse. Really, the issue is how to read one letter, and that is the Vav. The Vav that connects this to the previous verse. Ve'ha'aretz ha'tato vavo v'choshech al panei tahom. What does the and mean? Is the and a chronological and or not? Does it mean and then? In other words, first God created the heavens and the earth, and then this is how things are? Or is it not a chronological and? Which might mean that we're actually talking about before creation, this is how things are. Now Rashi advances the latter possibility. The real question, by the way, is, what's the first thing God created? Right? So one way of reading it is that the first thing God created are the heavens and the earth, but the earth was formless and void, and the next thing that God created was, Vayomer Elohim, Yehi Or, God created light. That's one way of reading it. It's not how Rashi reads it. The way Rashi reads it is, Breshit Bara Elohim means Breshit Baro Elohim, in the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth. Now the Vav means when. Ve'ha'aretz ha'tavo, in the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth, when the earth was formless and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Ruach Elohim was ra'chefet al p'nei ha'mayim, in the beginning of it all, when that was the situation, here's the first thing that happened, Vayomer Elohim, and God said, Vayehi Or. And therefore, the creation of light is the first thing that happened. For argument's sake, let's accept Rashi's interpretation. If that's the interpretation, then that means that verse 2 is actually describing the pre-creation state of the world. Right? Because the first act of creation is Yehi Or in verse 3, and verse 2 is describing what things were like before that. So now we get to your question, which is one second. The way you and I, this is the question of what Tov Avo is, the way you and I think of creation, most of us would think that creation means that what was there before creation. Like if I asked you, forget what the Torah says, what do you think was there before creation? Before God got busy creating the world, before there was any act of creation, right? Before the Big Bang, if you want to talk about it scientifically, what was there? Anybody? You'd say nothing.
No, I would say it's undefined.
What?
It's undefined.
Okay, that's clever, right? You might say.
I can't tell you whether it was something or, and no scientist can tell you whether it was something or nothing before the Big Bang.
Okay, so maybe it was undefined. So one of two possibilities. Either there was absolutely nothing, and by absolutely nothing, I mean absolutely nothing. Right? Now, how absolutely nothing is that, right? It means that if you would go out on a spaceship and you're in interstellar space, that's not what it was. Because that's still something. Now, you might say, what do you mean it's something? What's there? Well, Einstein says that there's something called the fabric of space-time. That's still around, right? There's dimensionality. There's the idea that there's three dimensions. Time is still out there. Before all of that, right? Because science says time and space themselves, those are creations. So there's no time, there's no space, there's literally nothing, right? The absolute void, that's one possibility. But that sure doesn't sound like what verse 2 is talking about. Verse 2 sounds like a whole lot of something. In this pre-creation state, it does not sound like creation ex nihilo. Does not sound like Rashi's view of things is that first there was nothing and then there was something. This sounds like, no, that's... If anything, there's a heck of a lot of water around, right? I mean, like, think about the verse. The world is formless and void. Choshech al pnei tam was very dark. What's the one thing there's a lot of? Ruach halakim rachefet al pnei ha mayim. It's a water world, right? As a matter of fact, if you think about the world, what's crazy about it is that if you actually form the image in your mind, what does it sort of kind of remind you of elsewhere in the Torah? And here's another intertextual parallel that you should pay attention to. Imagine the following scene. Actually, create the image in your mind. I'm going to paint you a mental picture, just the words of the text. Baratz haitavo tovavo, the world, it was very chaotic. It was very dark, darkness on the face of the deep. The only thing there is in this dark world is water everywhere. Okay, think about chaotic water. What is chaotic water? Dark, chaotic water. It's crashing all over the place. It's very dark. Sure sounds a lot like what event in the Torah? The Mabul. Sounds a lot like the Mabul. So it's almost like the Torah is intentionally creating this Mabul view of us, right? For it's like, in the beginning, boys and girls, it was the flood, right? Crazy. Like, why do that? Like, you really expect me to believe, like, that's how things started, the flood, right? Now, the crazy thing is that if you start looking at the story of the flood, and you actually read the aftermath of the flood, so you find a couple really cool things. The first thing you find is, Vayischar Elokim et Noach, Vayaver Elokim ruach al hamayim, Vayashaku hamayim. There was a flood, it was chaotic, and then God causes this wind of God to hover over the water. Sure sounds a lot like pre-creation, doesn't it? There was that wind. And then the next thing that happens is near Ura Sheharim, the water pulls back and dry land begins to appear, which is the next thing that happens in the creation story too, right? And then there's this little birdie that goes out and comes back with evidence of vegetation, which is like day three. Do you understand what's happening here? It's like there's a recreation story. So it's like we aren't crazy thinking that the flood is analogous to pre-creation. Not only is the flood analogous to pre-creation, what happens after the flood is analogous to creation. So why does the Torah do that? Why is the Torah giving me this view of seemingly nothingness by talking about a heck of a lot of somethingness? Now, another way of phrasing that question is, here's another way of phrasing the question. Generally speaking, in the creation story, whenever God creates something, you hear about it. So, when God creates vegetation, it says God created vegetation. When God creates animals, it says God creates animals. When God creates people, it says and God creates people. Generally speaking, that's the way it works, with an exception. The one thing that never gets created, but there seems to be plenty of, is water. The world starts with water. God never says, and then the Lord made water, and boy, was there plenty of it. Never says that. It's just water was there. What's that about? Like, water's a thing like everything else. How come we started with water? What gave water the right to always be there? Where did that come from? Right? Why did pre-creation come with pre-existing water? So these are going to be the set of questions that hopefully the Mishkan will answer. You ready? The starting set of questions. They're all sort of the same question, right? But just so that you can kind of get the kaleidoscope over here. Where did all the water come from? How come the water was not pre-created? How come there was stuff there before creation? Where did it come from, all this stuff? I thought everything got created. How come the pre-creation world looks so much like the flood? Okay, that's our beginning kaleidoscope of questions. Let me throw a couple more for you and then we'll call it a night. Question number two. Day three. What happens on day three? Remember day three? Tad She'aretz Desha. Vegetation. Culminating with fruit trees. Right? So very delicious. Like you could see living in that world, right? I mean, there's stuff. You know what I mean? Fruit trees. I'm good. You know, you got plenty of, right? You know what I mean? Garden of Eden. Okay, and on day four, the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars. Oh, very interesting. So you expect me to believe that before there was a sun in the world, there were fruit trees. It's like you don't have to be that much of a Buckian science to understand that that doesn't really fly so well. You know what I mean? It's like you don't even have to understand too much about photosynthesis to know that apple trees are going to have a hard time without any sun. How could it be? Why would the Torah do such a thing to try to sell me? Like, and you would think, like, oh no, because the Torah was talking about to very dumb people. They were not very sophisticated. And what if I would say that? Yes, you're very sophisticated. You're scientifically educated. But you see, the Torah was talking to primitive people. I'm sorry, you don't have to be very smart to figure out that this doesn't work. So why would the Torah try to sell this view of creation? It's such a strange thing to say that day three is fruit trees, day four is sun. Why would you possibly ever say such a thing? Okay, seems crazy. Question number two. Question number three. Let's go back to our visualization of creation for a moment. Imagine you're actually looking at creation. So get that picture of pre-creation in your mind. You ready? Okay, very chaotic, lots of water everywhere, and very dark, right? That's the way it is. Next event, I want you to picture it in your mind, so you can create a mind picture of what happens. Vayomer Elokim, and God said, Vayehi Or. Now what does it look like? Describe the scene.
A lot of water and light.
Still a lot of water. Still very chaotic. But it's not dark anymore, right? There's just, it's like there's light as far as the eye can see. It's like an overexposed photograph. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, where it's like just light everywhere. You can barely even see the water because there's so much blinding light, right? Because God turned on the lights. Which makes the very next words odd, doesn't it? Because the very next thing God does is Vayavdel Elokim Beina Or Ubeina Choshech, leading you to ask, how could God divide between light and darkness? The scene I'm looking at, there is no darkness, it's just light. Where did the darkness come from, such that you needed to divide between this light and darkness? When you turn on the lights, it's not dark anymore. That's the way light is. So where did the darkness come from after you turned on the light? A little bit of a strange thing. And one other thing. What was my other thing that I wanted to share with you in creation? Let me see if I can find it. One last thing. Give me your top three reasons that you would prefer to live in a solar system with a sun as opposed to a solar system without one.
Warmth.
Family feud. Top three reasons? Warmth.
Light.
Photosynthesis. Energy. All right? Those are a pretty good list. Right? Without any of these, we die. Warmth. It's not so fun living on Earth when it's minus 300 Kelvin. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really not fun. So it's really good to have a sun in the world because you can have some heat, you can have some light, you can have some energy. Let's look at the Torah's description of the utility of the sun on day 4. Yehi Ma'arot B'Rakia Hashamayim, God says, let there be luminaries in the heavens to divide between the day and between the night. These luminaries, Vayu La'otot U'Lumoadim L'Yamim U'Lishanim. These luminaries are going to help people make calendars. They're going to be able to understand where their festivals are. That's why there's the sun. I mean, like, that's not very high on my list. I'd much rather have heat, much rather have light, much rather have photosynthesis than have a convenient calendrical device. Now, it's true, the sun, the moon, and the stars do provide me a very convenient ways of marking time, right? Everything we know about the calendar, most of the things we know about the calendar, days, are really a function of light and dark cycles of the sun, right? One light and dark cycle equals a day. A light and dark cycle on the face of the moon equals a month. A light and dark cycle of the year equals a year when you have light days and dark days coming back to the same amount of time, where the light days and dark days occupy the same proportion of time during the day, then you know that a year has passed. So it is really helpful to have a sun and the moon and the stars to keep time and to keep the calendar, make no question about it. But on the level of priorities, it's just not high enough. So why does the Torah describe the sun in relatively trivial terms? Okay, so the deal is that when you do a two-part series on creation, that you have to come back the second time, because otherwise you turn into Api Karsim when you get left with these kinds of questions. We certainly wouldn't want to have that happen.
That the young Israel warrants these sort of Torah study sessions. That would be a terrible, terrible thing. So I invite you to come back next week. We will try to answer these questions by looking at the Mishkan. I'll see you then.